once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, December 14th, the year of our Lord, 2013, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Thought I'd throw you off there by saying things a little differently
didn't
and see if
work.
You could. It didn't,
work. No.
Okay.
I will be thrown off by something completely different.
Okay, that's all right. Well, we were talking a little about deflation at the end of the last hour, and I wanted to throw one other thing in here. Is quantitative easing...
Wait, you were trying to throw me off. Now you're throwing another thing in.
Yes.
There's a lot of throwing going around. Just do not throw
is
up.
Is quantitative easing deflationary? There's actually a school of economic thought now, if you want to call it a school. It's kind of like a school of fish.
You're right. They kind of swim around together, and sometimes they just separate.
This is interesting. Yes, they are saying... There are several economists who have published who are saying that... Quantitative easing, in other words, the buying of bonds, while it may have prevented a depression, and it probably did, are largely helped in preventing a depression, is when it is pulled back, will result in the economy surging ahead and the stock market rising dramatically. And we are almost certain to see quantitative easing pulled off the books probably early next year.
I'm going to give some...
Maybe sooner. I mean, this next meeting, they could say we're pulling the plug on.
I doubt it. I have a low... I think it's probably going to be in January, but they're supposed to be meeting...
Well, they could meet...
What is it, Tuesday?
Yeah, they could meet Tuesday and decide to do it in January, too.
Right, yeah. If you think about any time the Federal Reserve is in the news, you get weird reactions in the market. One, the Federal Reserve says... unemployment is down, we may taper. So the market drops. And the next day, well, on the same news, that the Federal Reserve thinks the market is the economy is healthy and that unemployment's lower, the market takes off. Or
yeah.
It could be reverse. Well, the day they say it, the market may take off and then drop the next day. And on the same news. The reason is that it's kind of like using a crutch for your broken leg. And you're trying to walk on the leg, and you have your crutch. And the crutch is quantitative easing. It's just helping support you. It's not really helping with the growth of the bone. It's not really helping with all kinds of things. And the doctor is saying, I may take that crutch away. I may swap that out for a cane in a little bit. And the patient's reaction is, I haven't been walking on my own for a while. Don't take that crutch away from me. Oh, wait a minute. I'm going to get to walk? Wait, okay, this is good.
Yeah,
and so there's a double reaction that's going on there.
My impression, after having read a lot by a lot of people, is that, first off, I'm quite confident, given that the numbers out there that we've seen in the last week about hiring, and particularly on the long-term averages, and about the GDP and the forecast for the GDP next
right.
year, and
housing starts,
the forecast for profitability next year, by the way, which are that we should see a massive increase in profitability in the corporate environment next year. All of these things strongly say the economy is finally at the recovery point,
fully recovered and moving forward.
So even though there's been a lot of discussion about reduction in the Fed's buying of bonds, I think the Fed will taper and cease buying bonds next year, probably beginning early next year. And the second thing that's going to happen, though, is that interest rates will remain extremely low. And
yep.
that's still very stimulative. But I really think getting the uncertainty out of the way, because markets do not particularly like uncertainty, will be healthy for everybody. Do I think Congress is going to do anything to make things better? Probably not. But one of the big issues occurred this last week, and I'm sure a lot of you are aware of this, and that is the fact that I never can remember the name of the Senate Budget Committee chairman, Patty something or another, and Congressman Ryan in the House.
Yeah.
Got together and reached a compromise, and it wasn't a big deal. Nobody had to give up anything. I mean, the Republicans can say no new taxes. No, they're not taxes; they're fees. And as they pointed out very nicely, the fees are voluntary. You don't have to fly.
Right.
You can drive.
Right.
And it's really such a tiny amount in both the federal employees having to contribute a little tiny bit more to their, and I mean a really little tiny bit. It was supposed to go up $49, I think it was, and instead it's going to go up $57. So it's like $8 a month from federal employees, plus an extra $2.50 per airline trip, by the way, which they changed the rules on that a little bit, talking about the geeky stuff. It used to be it was per leg of the trip.
Right.
And now the $2.50, the fee now applies for the entire trip rather than per leg of the trip. So if you have a a two aircraft transfer trip, your fee will be lower than it was before. Man, Congress, it's amazing. But the point is, they reached a budget framework that the House has already passed overwhelmingly. 64 people voted against it, most of them from Texas. And that will actually lock in the budgetary framework for this year and next year, for 2 years. And that takes a tremendous amount of uncertainty out. By the way, it did not raise the debt ceiling, but there's an imputed, we're not going to shut everything down and take us to the edge of the cliff again, message that came out of this, which will have a tremendous positive effect on investing in the economy.
Right.
And that and a series of other things that are going on, they're probably pretty thick. By the way, employers are hiring on average about 200,000 net a week. Now, that's not any big news. It's not going to shake the trees. But it's very, very consistent. And there's another thing out there that's very, very consistent that's showing up now that indicates we're really starting to get into a healthy position, and that is the number of unfilled jobs is rising faster than general hiring. And what that means is we're already beginning to see the edge of a shortage of skilled labor, which says a world about a lot of things, about what we need going forward. We need more people who have practical educations. We do have a shortage in the United States of people who are capable of walking into a job and doing the job, whatever the job may be. That indicates our economy is growing very nicely. What'd you say that PIMCO had raised next year's GDP guesstimate to be?
3.2.
Most of the economists that I read are saying 2.8. That seems to be pretty much the consensus, and it's like 1.3 this year. So what we're probably going to see going into 2014, and it's going to make some people very, very unhappy, is the economy begins to get some traction, begins to move forward, it comes off life support, and it begins to get into honest, healthy growth. And even the pessimists who have excellent track record are saying positive things. Ned Davis, there was an article in Barron's today. Ned Davis, and this is fair warning, I've just said next year the economy is going to do well. I would say we'll probably get a double-digit gain in the stock market next year in the United States, probably around 10%. That's my guess. But there's something I need to warn you about at this point, and that is it would be very unusual if next year at some point we don't get a market correction.
Right.
Simply not because the market's overvalued, but because we get these every once in a while. It's sort of like a psychological, we gotta do this. And this is the point that is critical, though, when we get this market correction. And I almost want to say when. I should say if, because it's not a certainty. But if you're an investor, recognize that at some point, fear and loathing are going to flood out from everywhere, and yeah. Oh my God, the world's coming to an end.
It's been too long since the last correction.
We're going to see the market suddenly drop, all the focus go on it, and all of the Chicken Littles are run from the door. But this is the point that is very important. A survey of major investors who are sitting on large quantities of cash, this is fascinating to me, are all anticipating this correction next year and want to see it happen because they want to buy into the depression.
Right.
And when the market declines, there's a lot of major investors out there sitting on large quantities of cash. They really didn't anticipate the market going up as much as it did this year. They think it may be overextended. They're waiting for a downturn in the market to jump in, which means that at the next downturn, we will probably see a commitment by institutional investors to the market at that point. And it'll probably take a downturn to get them there. And this is the amazing thing. On the backside of that correction, history and everything else tells us, buckle your seatbelts here, the market rise beyond that should be around 60%.
This is based on a lot of things in history. Anytime we come out of a long-term down period like what we've been through, and this is, we can track long-term bears and long-term bulls. We call them, instead of cyclical, we call them secular. They're pretty secular, yeah. That concept says that this market that we're in right now should be coming out of a secular bear and into a secular bull. Our secular bear actually started in the year 2000. It's been 13 years that we're in a relatively bear market condition with the little bursts of very tiny bulls followed by massive recessions. That happens historically, and it happens when we have a shift in technology, a massive shift in technology, and we're adjusting to it. If you think about the Great Recession and compare it to the Great Depression, you'll see that the piece of technology in the Depression was tractors and automated machine plants that were creating machines with machines instead of one person involved. And if you think of the tractor, you had 12 people in a field working, and suddenly you only needed one person to do that work in the field. Well, what do you do with the other 11 people? They went wandering looking for...
They go to California.
Yeah, they went to California to see, well, I'll
and I think they're still there.
As farmers over there. And it took a war to get us out of that. It took a war to take a large group, those 11 people, and train them in the industrial world of the military. And when they got back through the GI Bill, we're avoiding that now because we're all so good at retooling, at retraining. That I think that may be the biggest piece of the strength of the American economy right there. Many other economies, if the career that you've chosen for your life fails, they tend to find things that are less important and stay at them, or less well-paying or less influential, and stay at those careers for the rest of their lives. Americans tend to say, I'm not going to accept less than what I had, even if I have to do that temporarily. I'm going to re-educate myself. I'm going to learn how to do something or apply the skills that I already have to get the same kind of pay I was getting before. We tend to look at an underemployment issue where we've been hired to do something that we're way more than qualified to do as a temporary thing. This is why employers don't like to hire people that are overqualified, because they know they're overqualified. They know they can go somewhere else and get more. Well, we know that as Americans. We know that the better we are at what we do, the more we're going to get paid. We actually see that as a fundamental kind of basic knowledge. Even children have that here. But you go to other countries, that is simply not in the knowledge database. It's not something that they recognize. If you go to France and you're a business failure, nobody's ever going to trust you again. In the United States, if you have two people, this is great. The listening audience is going to appreciate this. One person is what we would call a trust fund baby. They've grown up pampered with as much money as they want for whatever they want. They make the decisions that they want to make, and they do whatever they want to do, and they show up at a cocktail party. And somebody else shows up at the cocktail party with the same degree of wealth. We'll call them billionaires. The second person has failed in business 8 times, and after every failure gets up and starts again, and has finally made a business that is functional and that's employing people. He shows up at the party. In America, who gets the most respect? It's a no-brainer. The person that keeps dusting themselves off and wiping the blood off their lip and going forward anyway is by far more respected. But you go to almost any place else in the world, with the exception maybe of Australia, and even there, the old money mentality is so strong. The trust fund baby, the child of the Lord and Lady, gets far more respect than the self-made person. Our strength is our flexibility and our inability to take failure. We say, I failed, but I'm going to use that for the next stepping stone.
Voluntary failure is a big plus in America.
Right.
Now, let me explain voluntary
failure. Yes, I know where you're going. Yeah.
One of the ratios that is important to understand when you're looking at when we're looking at the economy is the layoff to quit ratio.
Yeah.
In the Great Recession and during that time period, relatively few people were willing to quit. So very few people quit jobs.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of layoffs. Well, in this in October, the layoffs were 1.5 million. Were either laid 1.5 million Americans were laid off or fired in October. But 2.4 million quit their jobs to move on to another job.
So you're talking about a very large,
yes, very large differential there.
Majority were quitting rather than being laid off.
And people don't quit and then just not do anything. In most cases, when people quit, they have another job, or
right,
they're confident enough they're
upgrading,
can get another job, that they're moving to something better. And there's a whole series of numbers out there that, particularly when we look at it over the longer term, show a very, very healthy increase in hiring. And while we haven't seen wages go up yet, I mean, the wage growth over the last 12 months has been less than inflation, and that's generally not a good thing. I'm gonna venture out there and say we will see wage growth rise to above inflation next year, which oddly enough is not inflationary. It is healthy. Now it can be if it goes too far, but
the reason why it's not inflationary is productivity has come up
right
so far. And when we talk about productivity, if you have a person that a year ago was making 5 items in the year and this year is making 6 or 7 items and he's getting paid the same, giving that person a raise isn't going to cause inflation, mm-hmm, because they're creating more
right
value.
And the backside to this, and the funny thing about economics is nothing in economics exists in a vacuum.
Except for vacuum sales.
Those don't exist in a vacuum either, because the vacuum companies make money and then they spend it on something else. There's a multiplier effect in everything. And as more people become employed, they have more money to spend in the economy.
Yep.
And since about 2/3 of our gross domestic product can be traced to people buying stuff,
consumer spending,
then we have a critical element moving forward. By the way, I can understand why the 64 people in the House of Representatives voted against that bill. It does
the budget
agreement, the compromise,
One that was actually passed by the House and
because
may actually get passed by the Senate.
Compared with sequester, it spends, now notice this is fascinating, about $60 billion over the next 2 years, about $60 billion more
than what would have happened.
And so that $60 billion will go into the economy and somebody will get it, and likely, by the way it's set up, a lot of it will turn right around and be spent.
Right.
And that is, in essence, a stimulus to the economy. Now, obviously, it would amount to raising spending, but this is the other side of this. For those of you who object to raising the spending a little bit rather than lowering it next year, it did not rise as fast as inflation.
Correct.
So the end result is that there's more dollars going into the economy than we would have seen through sequestration. We got a new word in the language, if nothing else.
Sequestration. Well, it's been there for a while.
Well,
Andrew Jackson tried to use it. You know, there've been.
Did anyone actually use the word sequestration?
Oh yeah,
though?
Yeah. It's usually used by the executive
but
branch.
I'll guarantee that the common well, I don't know if common people know it yet. We're pretty uncommon people.
Right. The cryptozoologists have been trying to find a sequestered Sasquatch for a long time.
Well, the Syro cryptozoologists are the ones you've got to watch out for. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And it's probably time to play some important economic stimulus messages from Town Square Media. And we'll be back on the other side of these messages from KTM's owners. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers to call in here, 773-1400 locally or
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
And if you're wondering if this is a recorded show, if today for you is Saturday, December 14th, 2013, then this is live and in living color. If you're living in another day, then you have to have a time machine to call us.
Yeah, see, it's very hard to get through. We haven't had any calls.
No, so obviously the time machines are in short supply.
I have such trouble because I occasionally will hear that our ratings are stellar and people are talking about how wonderful it is that we have such high ratings and that we've got higher than even weekday ratings on a weekend, and they talk about it. There, see.
Oh, woo. You did it.
Through here and then we have people not call because they're so busy listening to us that they're like, wow.
We need to get really boring and that way they'll call us.
We'll just do 30 minutes of silence.
No, I don't think that'll work. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Jake, I have a question for you.
Oh, dear. Put me on the spot.
I know over the past few weeks you talked about the Affordable Care Act. I don't want to get into the same discussions we've been in before, but just you always say that if you could make some changes, you have some thoughts about what they'd be. I'd just like to hear your thoughts on what you would change if you could to improve it.
Okay.
And I'll hang up and listen.
I appreciate that. Thanks for the call. All right. First thing is we're going to talk pie in the sky here. We're gonna get out the...
Now, this is very dangerous. Pie in the sky.
It's cloudy with a chance of pie in the sky.
That you need to go inside for that.
Right. If you need a larger umbrella for this, I would recommend...
Yes.
They've got the pavilion umbrellas out at the restaurants.
Okay,
you can go stand under those for a moment.
Yes, go ahead.
First off, I think that when you take a federal mandate and you apply it to state laws, you have some very major issues that you've got to go over. We haven't removed the authority of the states to regulate insurance. Insurance is regulated at state level all across the United States. And in some states, it's regulated at the county level or the parish level. And each parish, in some cases, each county, for instance, Florida, has its own set of insurance laws. If you are a large insurance company and you wish to put out a health plan of any kind and you wish it to be somewhat regular across the country, too bad. This is the problem when it comes to comparing one health care plan to another. Each company has to come up with a different plan in every state, which means that they don't have a lot of time to compare with their competitor in every state. You don't have a uniform set of laws. So my first pie in the sky idea is do something like what was done by the states for securities laws. There's something called the Blue Sky Laws were passed. It started with Kansas and it went to every state in the United States.
It took a long time.
It took many decades. Every state in the United States has a nearly identical law on the sale and purchase of securities. It's called the Blue Sky Laws. Otherwise, the United States government would have to pass an amendment to the Constitution to regulate trade within a state rather than interstate. Well, it's pie in the sky, but I think the only way it's going to get started is if people start talking to their state legislatures. If they start saying, all right, who's going to be the first to pass a law that says these are the rules that should govern insurance companies?
Well, one of them did. Massachusetts.
Well, everybody, all of them did. They all said, well, these are the laws that should, we're going to do it. But they're not communicating with each other in the process. And that's the thing. There is no cross-border state communication with legislatures saying, how is the best way, if we started, if you think of the concealed handgun laws, you've got concealed handgun laws that are reciprocal across a whole bunch of different states. They're different laws, but they are cooperative. They overlap a little bit, but they're basically saying the same things. That's not as identical as the securities law. One of the problems with the Affordable Care Act is that it has to create a standard of exchange of these insurance companies that is different in every state. The fact that they have to take into account the insurance laws for every state when creating an exchange at the federal level, or every state that might require the exchange.
Well, the exchanges are all state level.
Right. Yeah. Well, the federal exchange, though, is applied to all the states that decided not to do it themselves.
Let me throw my 2 cents worth. This is Jeff. Let me throw my 2 cents worth. First off, the majority of what's going on in the Affordable Care Act makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It's a compromise, and it's a compromise because we in the United States wouldn't accept the whole thing, the whole hog handed to us, which what we're going to eventually see. A lot of people are going to think that I'm nuts here.
Well, that's not new. We thought that already.
Let me tell you something that would work very, 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 very effectively. I mean, just every study has agreed on this. Everybody who's looked at it hard has agreed on it. The most cost-effective, now, and I'm not going to say it's going to be the most popular, and a lot of people are not going to like it. The most cost-effective way to establish equitable health care and get the prices down. You ready for this?
I'm ready. I'm not sure I'll agree with it, but I'm ready.
We have a program that's been around for over 50 years, and they've experimented with it a lot, and there's been some tremendous improvements made on it a lot. It already drives the pricing in the healthcare system almost totally, except for a few exceptions, and those exceptions are the ones that are really upset now because they're being locked out of Obamacare, by the way.
Right.
And it's called Medicare.
See, I'm going to disagree with that.
Okay.
Because it isn't, in my opinion, the most cost-effective.
Well, if you look at the it may not be in your opinion, but the point is it is what drives the pricing.
Let me tell you why before we just glaze over that. If we look at the price of a procedure 10 years ago versus the price of the same procedure, it may have some new technology associated with it today. We see in Medicare, as well as most areas of insured medicine, the prices have come up pretty drastically.
Right.
If you go out to a place where insurance isn't involved, you know, there was gastric bypass or facelift or tummy tuck or LASIK eye surgery, the things that are elective,
prices have come down.
Not only have they come down,
but the quality
has gone up tremendously and the prices have come down.
But this is the point. In those areas, you don't have people walking into the hospital, into the emergency room, say, I need a tummy tuck.
That is correct.
And However, that is where the pricing differential comes in.
Let me address that. Most of the cost of medical care is not emergency care.
No, it's post-emergency care.
No, it's not even that. It's elective care. I mean, not elective, it's preventative care. It is ongoing preventative care or ongoing care once preventative care isn't enough. Emergency care is expensive. But if you go into emergency care and then they put you somewhere else, so what I'm coming to
I disagree
to
with
this,
you on that statement you just made.
Which part?
When you consider that in the last 2 years of the average person's life in the United States, over half of the total medical expense of their entire lifetime is expended in the last 2 years of their lives, that's not preventative care.
It's true.
However, the majority of it is in...
This is where I'm coming back to.
Okay.
For the vast majority of people, those last 2 years of life already take place in what you call the most cost-effective way. The last 2 years of life usually takes place when they're in Medicare. We can't really adjust that for the rest of us. So when you're talking about the majority of of care that we can change right now without messing with Medicare, which is kind of hands-off. Don't mess with that.
No, but I'm wanted. If you want a pie in the sky, I would mess with Medicare.
You would. I would, too. I would.
Yeah.
But I would start at a level where we could compare insurance plans and where we could put our own price negotiation of the actual patient consumer into the equation. Because when it comes to an office visit, when I go to speak to a doctor, the doctor doesn't know how much they're charging.
Right.
That even if they're in private practice, the people that know how much is being charged are the people in the other room.
But the other, you didn't let me finish
the
thing. Okay,
please.
Medicare would be the baseline. But rather than charging by the procedure, I would take the HMO model and say, you sign up a patient, you get this many dollars a month. Here's the standards. And by the way, if you're in an HMO, like at Scott & White or something, and you're in a group plan, that's exactly the way it works. We have Scott & White Healthcare at our business.
Which we like
a lot. And we give them a certain amount of money a month, and in return, they provide all the healthcare necessary for us, and there are certain minimum standards they have to meet, but they want to keep us. In other words, basically putting the whole nation on a system like that. And as far as the penalties are concerned,
this is where the other side of this is the side we covered some part of this, but the other side of cost isn't just having the insurance company involved. Right now, trying to figure out what I'm being charged for a procedure, I get a bill from the hospital, who's also sending the bill to the health plan. I don't know what any of that stuff is.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get to say what it was at the beginning. Even
right.
if I thought I did, I'm not sure about it.
I agree with you completely.
It goes to the health plan.
But there's no way in the world you're going to shop because you get the bill after the fact.
Oh, but that's not the case. I went in and was talking to my doctor, and I said, and I went through the list of things that I thought I was going to need, and I priced them out. And I said, okay, which of these is really necessary? These are the sorts of things that people do in LASIK surgery. They do this in a lot of other ways.
Right.
It's just very, very difficult when an insurance company is the intermediary to say, I don't want to spend that. I want to spend this, because the insurance company is the one that does all the negotiating. The insurance company is the one that says yes or no to specific treatments. And there's
gets really complex. Let me throw something else. Yeah, in those areas that you're talking about, the price has gone down. But if you go to a hospital as an individual, or if you go to a doctor as an individual without insurance, you're going to be paying much higher prices than the insurance company pays.
That may be what the surface level looks like, but what I have experienced is that, for instance, private practice doctors, if they hear that you don't have insurance, they're worried that you're not going to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So they give you discounts. And they give you discounts that are below the level that they're giving to the insurance companies.
Speaking as a person who was without health insurance and who had illnesses in our family.
Still quite expensive, yes.
Well, what I'm saying is I discovered that what I was being asked to pay to the hospitals and the doctors, and I mean they were serious and wouldn't budge on this, was roughly twice what health insurance was paying for the same procedures.
Yeah, that is the case before. I would recommend that you try this out because I've done this with Scott & White.
Okay.
I have had bills come to me that, you know, part of my deductible or part of my copay extra was due, and they send it and they say, you owe this much. So I call up to pay. And so, this is an example, and I'll use it. Personal, myself, I call up. There's an $804 bill that I owe.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on series of treatments. And so I call in and I say, oh, okay, this is $804. I'd rather not spend this all at once. Can we do this monthly? Just because I feel like if I can get a 0% loan from the hospital for this, that's pretty cool. I'll pay it monthly.
Right.
And they say, well, we would much prefer if you paid it all at once. We can discount this. So we started negotiating the discount, and I got it cut in half.
You got down to what the insurance company pays.
Except the insurance company has already got the discount on there. I'm only paying what's left after the discount from the insurance company.
Well, they assume, by the way, when they send these bills out, there's an assumption when they bill that most people will not pay the bill.
Correct. So the fact that I can negotiate and bring that down is important.
But let me take. Let's go back to the Affordable Health Care Act again.
Yes, let's go back to it.
There are a series of changes that anyone who has looked at that bill, and I don't have them all in my head right now. I've looked at them in the past.
You don't have all the bills in your head?
For example, let me give you an example. If a registered American Indian, and there are registered American Indians,
right,
is part of a tribe, and they have the benefits of that tribe, and it's a treaty benefit and all of that,
yep,
their health care is paid for by the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Yep.
However, in the Affordable Health Care Act, due to an oversight,
mm-hmm,
the definition of Indian says lives on the reservation.
Whoops.
So that means that as soon as an American Indian decides to get off the reservation and get a job instead of being on the most extensive welfare system available outside of Social Security, as soon as they go out and try to do something for themselves, they immediately lose the health care that they as a
treaty.
So under the Department of the Interior, the various acts associated with the Department of the Interior, that person is still legally a special category of person, American
right.
Indian, still has all the rights and privileges of an American Indian that is properly
citizen
registered.
Citizen of a different country, as well as our own.
But because of an oversight in the Affordable Health Care Act, they are penalized for leaving the reservation and going and getting a job.
Yeah.
Now, there have been both in the House and in the Senate, there have been bills introduced to correct this and a whole series of other things.
There's a lot of issues
those
that could
who
be
want,
fixed quickly.
Those who want the Health Care Act to fail have refused to even bring them, allow them to go forward.
Here's a small thing. Less pie in the sky, more reality.
Mm-hmm.
The HSA, Health Savings Account.
Right. That could be fixed.
There are health savings accounts. There's medical savings accounts. There's health medical savings accounts. There's a number of different...
Yeah, and they irritate the fire out of me.
And some of them, you put money in, and it disappears at the end of the year if you haven't spent it, which means that you've lost all the money. Or others, the original, the health savings account, is one that the money would roll over to the next year. You wouldn't lose that money. It requires that you have a high deductible on your plan.
Which is now illegal.
Well, no, it's still legal. It's just very much more narrowed. Here's the issue, and this is one of the things that I think should be changed immediately. I think it's dumb.
Mm-hmm.
If you are on a plan as a single person, the deductible, the minimum deductible that's considered high deductible, is $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if you're in this $1,500 deductible plan and you're one person, not a family, you can go start a health savings account, which means you can put money in there tax deductibly.
Yeah.
You don't have it's pre-tax.
Right.
You can, or if you set it up as an individual, you can deduct
right.
the money that goes
right.
in there, and you can use that money for qualified medical expenses, dental stuff, or
yes.
getting prescriptions, a lot of things that you would normally have to use after-tax money to do.
Right.
Okay. If you're in a family and you have a deductible on each member of the family of $1,500, it doesn't work the same way.
Right.
Because your family deductible has to be over $3,000. What it means is that if you're in a family, you can't have an HSA for the same at the same level that a single person can.
And starting next year, you can't have one because it's too high a deductible.
Right, because of the
Affordable Care Act. Yeah.
So, and this year, as a matter of fact, what you can deduct into the HSA is much lowered because there's a tax, Affordable Care Act.
Congress is very, very generous, and then in the corporate version of that animal,
mm-hmm.
they allowed $500 to carry over to the next year,
the medical savings account.
It is so silly. Why should you lose the money if you're healthy during the year and you? Why should you just
It's gone. It just goes away.
Where does it go? By the way,
That's a good question.
You go back to the
it's different employer? For every state.
Oh,
it doesn't go back for the employer in some states. In some states, it goes to the state. In some cases, it goes to the federal government. In some cases, it goes back to the employer. Some cases it gets kicked back out to the person that put it in, but they have to pay taxes on it.
No, it's just it's frankly it's absurd.
And it's not only every state. But medical savings accounts are a lot like 401ks in that they're provided by an employer, but they're also defined by the plan that the employer put together.
This is one of the things I would like to have us do. And I would like it to have a medical / retirement savings account that's in addition to the IRA.
Yeah.
Everybody can contribute to it.
That was the idea between the HSA.
But the whole point is
HSA.
Everybody can contribute to it. It's tax deductible without, I mean, just period for everybody.
Yeah.
To make it simple, it's tax deductible. And if you don't, and you use it to pay medical expenses,
if you don't pay taxes on it.
But if you don't spend it, you get to keep it.
Yeah, that's what the original HSA is.
You know, what that would do.
And it still exists.
What that would do is it would give people an incentive to bargain.
Exactly.
For lower health care costs.
They then have money sitting in an account that they say, I have to spend this. How can I get the best bang for my buck?
But I'm saying you don't have to even spend it. If you have good health.
Correct.
You're probably going to live longer.
You'll have it sitting in there for
a
long time to come.
And that helps offset the shortfall we have in savings in the United States for retirement.
Yeah.
So basically we say...
You can use it for retirement. You can use it for medical. If you use it for medical, you don't pay any taxes on it. If you use it for retirement, you pay taxes on it later,
and
an IRA.
I would even go so far as to say... It'd be like Social Security and Medicaid, Medicare.
Right.
It's a mandatory deduction. It goes into the account.
Totally agree with
and
that.
And you get to spend it only on qualified medical expenses or in retirement.
I totally agree. I think that that would be an excellent move on the part of the government. Put it in a place where everybody, if you are on any kind of employment, some of the money needs to go out into this
And we account. Have so we have to play some more comicals.
That's more pie in the sky stuff, but there's some fairly simple stuff where they can lower the deductible for the HSA.
Right. I'm just giving him a hard time. Hey, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we have about 3.5 minutes of commercials to play here, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got about another 5 minutes left in this second hour on this December 14th, 2013. And the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And before we bail out of here, there is what we hope to be a very important action done in the Senate, presuming that and I'm not being partisan here, it's simply a fact, Republicans are trying to stop all action in the Senate right now, and that makes me a little bit nervous. I understand they're mad because the rules were changed. But
filibuster rules, yeah.
Janet Yellen is scheduled to come up for confirmation, and the Republicans so far have not offered to limit their debate time. I don't think anyone objects to Janet Yellen being the next Federal Reserve
chairperson. They're trying to make a point,
chairperson.
But don't make it at the expense of the country.
And I
recognize that the point they're trying to make is important. It is a good point.
And it's entirely possible that they will slow the process down enough that she won't get confirmed, and I suppose we'll survive her not being confirmed.
I kind of feel like it's the same sort of thing as when the air traffic control people go on strike. I'm like, you've made your point, but now you're stopping everything.
Yeah, and the other thing that's very, very significant, and those of you who don't know who Janet Yellen is, I'm sorry, she's been the deputy chairman. She's an academic.
Of the Federal Reserve,
And she has a tremendously nonpartisan, very, very highly qualified background to continue to steer our economy forward in a rational fashion. She's a known factor. She's quite impressive.
Brilliant.
But just as impressive is who the president is strongly rumored at this point, and I presume he's put it, his White House has leaked this. There is a Stanley Fisher.
He's actually been appointed. That happened yesterday.
He was appointed? He doesn't have to be confirmed by the Senate?
No, his vice chair doesn't need to be approved.
He is phenomenal. He just came from
a confirmation is all it is.
Tour. But does he have to be confirmed?
No.
Okay. Anyway, he has just come from heading the Bank of Israel. He is a joint
governor of the Bank of Israel.
Governor,
lead governor of the Bank of Israel,
which is the equivalent of the chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Correct.
Here.
Yeah.
And he is a truly amazing person on the world scene. The International Monetary Fund members voted him as the best leader during the financial crisis. Bernanke got number two. He
took Israel through the recession with
hardly a blip.
It was amazing.
And he was born in Zambia. Became a U.S. citizen in 1976.
He was born in Rhodesia. It's now Zambia. That's when it was South African Rhodesia, which is now two countries.
Okay, but at any rate, he's born in what is now Zambia. But the point is that he has served at Citibank. He has, in other words, he's been in the corporate world, he's been in the government world, he's been in the academic world. Now, this is the key. He's 70 years old. He was the mentor professor
of Ben Bernanke.
Of Bernanke, Yellen, Summers, who else? You start down the list of the people who...
He's been in communication in a friendly manner with with Greenspan for...
In other words,
this is
just an astonishingly good choice. Admittedly, he's 70 years old, but he it's frankly the Federal Reserve looks like it's about to be headed by the dream team.
Yeah, and this is the key point, and this is a good one. His policy, Stanley Fisher's policy, has been firmly, openly, clearly against long-term fiscal stimulus by a banking committee.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got Yellen coming in, and she knows she's going to start tapering. She has to. This is kind of her job coming into the deal. She's got to start tapering. And she's got somebody in there that is going to be one of the best, well, he's probably the best choice out there to help her do it.
What I get here is President Obama is near nominating. Did he actually? It's just a nomination. I may be wrong, but... Yeah. My understanding is that he hasn't officially nominated him yet and that the Senate has to approve him. But that's I could be wrong on that, but that's my understanding. We're out of time. This has been the Personal Wealth Coach, which is we're both an SEC-registered investment advisor in Salado, handling large wealth management portfolios, and we are obviously a radio show. If you'd like to hear us talk about something, you'd like to contact us off the air, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. 947-1111, there's a voicemail.
Also 1-800-914-PLAN.
Or you can contact us at either Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. We'll be back next week. Serving Central Texas.